Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
And this is why we did this, to make sure that the younger generation had a background to their family heritage to see how they were connected.
I'm Regini Vaidyanathan, and for the BBC World Service, I've come to the state of Kansas, in the heart of America, to look at some of the many ways in which race affects this country today. And in this second programme of four, I'm looking at economic opportunity.
So if you pass on your heritage to your children that's been raised in the city...
The small township of Nicodemus sits in the northwest of Kansas. And at the town's annual reunion, they're celebrating what this place stands for. Nicodemus is steeped in history. Built in 1877, it was seen as the promised land for African Americans who travelled here after slavery ended, to make a new life.
After Lincoln freed them in 1865, it took them 12 years to get $5, which was the price of the ticket to ride a train.
In its early days, there was a general store, two hotels, a bank and a post office. But the economic prosperity the settlers chased never materialised. After a railway, which was due to pass through Nicodemus, was built instead through another town. This one decision sucked economic opportunities from the area, turning it from a thriving centre to a rural farm town, something it remains today. Access to resources had a profound impact on what was allocated to people, and it's a running theme in the history of Black America.
Strong people, because this soil up here is not the best because you got a lot of rocks in it.
Yet one of the biggest developments of the last 50 years has been the growth of a large and vibrant Black middle class. And here in Nicodemus, Derek Moore, who I met in the last programme, took me to meet his dad, Rich Moore. Rich is a successful executive who rose from the bottom to the top of the corporate ladder and these days spends his time on and off corporate jets, attending board meetings.
I can tell you that it almost gets emotional sometimes. That jet would leave Denver. We had a large manufacturing facility in Denver, and our route would take us directly over Nicodemus. And I can't tell you how it felt to look out there and understand that those people went through hell and gave me an opportunity. It was quite unique. So that's kind of my story.
The story makes Rich emotional, and it hints at the gratitude he feels for the opportunities open to him. Being successful and wealthy hasn't insulated him from race problems, but it has given him an opportunity to see them from a different angle and to do something about them.
I sat on something called the Executive Council, and I recall us having a conversation. These are all executives around the room, and I had pointed out the fact that we had kind of dismal results in terms of women being promoted as well as African Americans being promoted. And so we engaged in a dialogue about why that was taking place. Now, none of the other executives were willing to say, I have a very strong racial bias or I have a gender bias, and that's why it exists this way. What it turned out, one person stepped up, who was very vocal, and said, listen, Rich, here's what you got to understand. We're not going to promote people that we're not comfortable with. I go, whoa. Right. So I said, I have yet, and at this time I'd been in the company maybe 25, 26 years. I said, I've never seen it stated that a requirement for a promotion is that someone has to be comfortable with you. Now, when this person stepped up and said, I'm not promoting anyone unless I'm comfortable with them, almost all of them nodded their head. Now, that would mean it's almost impossible for anyone who doesn't look like them, who doesn't come from their culture, that's not in their neighborhood, that didn't go to their schools, things of that nature, they're never going to get promoted. They would never document that because you'd be sued till the house come home. But that's the way they were implementing the system. To me, that's about as racist and as biased as anything I can think of, And so we had to have a very serious conversation about that. And I could see how it had played out so many times in my own career.
As Rich and I were talking, his daughter Nicole and his son-in-law Lewis, who are also career professionals in corporate America, came over to listen. Afterwards, they shared their stories with me too. Here's Lewis's.
One of the worst things was the experience of being in a bathroom. I have on a suit, tie, the whole nine yards, working for a Fortune 500 company. And I'm in there, and two white men walk. Well, one white man is in there, another one comes in, and they greet each other by saying, "What's up, my n***?" to each other. And I'm in the room. And I said something in the most professional way that I could and left.
And stories like these of racial discrimination in the workplace are so common that in 2003, Diva Pager, a professor of sociology and public policy who now teaches at Harvard University, set out to study the problem systematically. She looked at job seekers in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So in this field experiment, I hired young men to pose as job applicants, and I sent them all over the city applying for real low-wage jobs. I assigned them fictitious matched resumes that reflected identical levels of education and work experience, and then had them apply for these jobs to see how employers responded to otherwise identical applicants who differed only by race, ethnicity, or criminal record. So I found significant effects on all dimensions. So blacks were about half as likely to receive a callback or job offer relative to identically qualified white applicants. And actually, a black applicant with a clean record fared no better than a white applicant who'd just been released from prison. It suggests that employers essentially view a felony conviction as being similar to being African-American in this country today.
You did just hear that right. According to Diva's study, employers treat being black the same as having a serious criminal conviction. It was as shocking for her as it probably is for you. And so she thought she'd better test her results.
So at first I thought maybe this research was unique to Milwaukee. It's a highly segregated city. It has a long history of racial tension. And so I decided to replicate the study in New York City. New York is, as you know, a large cosmopolitan city with, you know, generally known for fairly progressive attitudes. And so we did a very similar kind of study there and found almost identical results. I think it points to the fact that race is not something that has disappeared as a factor from decision-making in key economic contexts, and that it remains a really salient dimension for allocating opportunity.
And that's a particularly relevant observation, because Diva says her study turned up very few signs of overt racial prejudice amongst employers. In other words, they weren't setting out to be racist. And in many ways, that's how racism operates today in America. It's a more insidious, subtle form, which not everyone can see or relate to. It's those boardroom conversations about needing to feel comfortable with a new employee, or the casual racism in an office toilet, while for others, it's about being followed around in a shop because the assistant assumes that if you're black, you're about to steal something. But for many black Americans, these types of daily challenges in the workplace are overlaid by a greater one, which is living and trying to raise a family on an extremely low income. African Americans have the highest rates of poverty. More than a quarter of black people in this country are poor, compared with around 10% of whites. And a survey from 2013 showed how stark the contrast is. It valued the assets of the median white household at just over $141,000. Compare that with $11,000 for the median black household and little over $13,000 for Hispanics. And shockingly, and in a rarely discussed part of this country's history, that huge disparity often happened because of deliberate government policies.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come.
What happened is that the racial exclusion was written into the Federal Housing Administration rules of the 1930s, developed as a part of the New Deal.
That's historian Bill Worley, I met him in Kansas City, Missouri. For decades, those government rules he's talking about excluded millions of black Americans from the biggest generator of wealth in the 20th century, the housing boom.
Those continued with the racial exclusion into the 1960s. It was only at the very end of the Johnson administration that those began to be written out.
So you're telling me that in the 1930s, part of the New Deal, the federal
right.
government had written in clauses that said black people couldn't buy certain houses?
What they said was that neighborhoods were classified by race. They drew maps of every American city of size, including Kansas City. But it goes even down to blocks and houses in the maps. They are very detailed.
Those maps literally had the black areas of town outlined in red ink. And so it became known as redlining. And to show me how dramatically all this encouraged America's huge racial disparity in wealth, not just here in Kansas City, but in cities across America, Bill and I drove about 10 blocks east to a much more deprived neighborhood.
There were real estate agents who specialized in speeding up the process of transition from white to black. The term that's used is blockbusting. And basically, agents would have a straw buyer, a white buyer, buy a house, then they would turn around and immediately sell it by arrangement with the agent to a black family. And once a black family moved in, the fear factor set in as far as the whites were concerned, and they would do their best to get out as rapidly as possible. And that meant that the prices plummeted. Now, if you put that blockbusting together with what is now known as redlining, it meant that that, too, brought down the resale property value that the outgoing white families would receive. But it also meant, ultimately, that black families could not even borrow money to improve their property above a certain level because they couldn't get a loan.
How legal was this redlining practice?
Absolutely legal. Theoretically, redlining has been outlawed in the United States since the early 1970s. But in fact, the reality is that redlining still occurs, figuratively, if not literally on a map, because banks will only finance either new purchases or home remodeling up to a certain level. In this neighborhood, maximum would be probably somewhere in the $100,000 level because the properties will not bring more than that.
But where we've just come from, 10 streets away, we're talking about property values of nearly $500,000.
Correct. The transition takes place that quickly. And that's true, again, of most American cities, but it's certainly graphically apparent in Kansas City.
And demographically, we're talking about this, where we're standing, being a majority black area, and that's a majority
white
area.
Not just majority, we're talking about 90 to 95% black. Where we're standing, and 10 blocks away, it would be 95 to 100% white.
But while studies have shown that the majority of poor whites often have a motor out of poverty through access to a good school, poor blacks typically live in areas of concentrated disadvantage. I'm in New York City for the BBC World Service, heading up to Harlem, the historic cultural centre of black America, to talk to Samuel Roberts, a professor in African American history and public health at Columbia University, about the effect of this structural disadvantage.
By the 1980s here in Harlem, an African American man had a life expectancy which was lower than a man in Bangladesh. And it was due to a whole host of factors, such as poor health outcomes, stress, lack of nutrition, things that are generally associated with, you know, really dire poverty. Then there's also the environmental assaults. In black urban communities, we see higher rates of lead paint poisoning in children. We see asthma rates 2, 3, 4 times as high as you see in white children in suburban areas. We see violence, a whole host of things, which all contribute to lowered life expectancy and lowered quality of life as well.
What sets this apart from a white American who lives in poverty?
There are a few things that might separate white poverty from black poverty. So in the interpersonal, for example, we just find simple racism in the workplace. We know that African Americans are often the last to be hired and the first to be fired. Then there's structural factors. Jobs leaving center cities and leaving families trapped in downward economic mobility has been a problem for decades now.
Some people might wonder, Samuel, why some black Americans are unable to climb out of this spiral of poverty.
The idea of climbing out of poverty presumes that there's a ladder, something with which you may climb out. And circumstances here have gotten to a point for many people where that ladder is not there. If one attends a failing school, one will not attain the level of education and knowledge to find suitable work, the kind of work, you know, which one would hope would bring oneself out of poverty and able to also raise and sustain a family. If one attains an education of some quality, but the jobs are not there, or people are not willing to hire them, then that becomes another problem.
Well, I've left Harlem now and I'm on the train, traveling about 120 miles south to another deprived neighborhood, only this time in the west of the city of Philadelphia, to see what a comprehensive approach to tackling the problem, one supported by President Obama and the city government, looks like.
Ladies and gentlemen, in just a few moments, we'll be arriving in Philadelphia.
I'm a West Philly guy. I actually grew up not 12 to 13 blocks from here. My mother still lives 7 blocks away.
Everett Gillison was, when I visited him in 2015, the deputy mayor of Philadelphia.
None of this stuff is individualized. It all has to be dealt with in a holistic way. And so we started a number of different programs to kind of look at not just criminal justice in isolation, but also where it fits on economic development, where it fits into job creation, where it fits on neighborhood development, where it fits on revitalization. All of it is connected, and that's been the ethos, quite frankly, of what we've done in our administration. We're standing right now in a great park in West Philadelphia, just outside of the Center City area, and it is part of our what's known as the Promise Zone.
Philadelphia has the highest poverty rate of any large American city, and this new approach helps to bring agencies together to tackle endemic disadvantage in an area which is two-thirds black. The Promise Zone doesn't come with any money, but Eva Gladstein, who runs it, seems to think that might be a good thing.
The lack of a grant really forces people to make a decision. Do we want to be a part of this because the money is there, or do we want to be a part of it because it aligns with our goals and our mission and we're invested in this community? So it really helps separate out who was serious and who was able to work with each other, and that's been a great experience.
How do we know whether this is a success in 3 years' time?
Well, this is supposed to be a 10-year program, and so some of the success will come in a longer term. But having said that, you know, the goal is for us really to move the needle around employment and unemployment, probably most significantly, and then kind of attached to that around housing and our small businesses and the condition of our commercial corridors.
In many people's minds, improving an area like West Philadelphia means gentrification. Wealthy, often white people, moving in and changing the character of a neighborhood. I asked Everett Gillison about that.
This community has always been resilient. And I always take issue with the word gentrification. Renewal is what happens in communities if you're part of cities. The entire history of cities across the world is that they are constantly renewing themselves. They are constantly bringing in people from outside, and they are constantly at the cutting edge of that blending that goes on. And at different times, people will look at it and say that there are winners and losers. It's tying to opportunity that really will help the influx of people. There are so many abandoned homes in this area for people who have just died off. So the opportunity is here for the community members who want to, if they just had an opportunity at making a living wage, they could buy the same homes that their mothers, their fathers, their uncles and aunts should be able to have left behind. And as long as we can get it into our land bank, turn it around and get it right back out so that they can actually afford it, we should be able to provide not only jobs, but we should be able to provide an opportunity. And we can do all of that and have the opportunities here. So the kids that are being educated here are staying and they're going to buy. And the neighbors that are here, the houses are still affordable and can buy. And if we can give them the opportunity for jobs, they'll stay. And that will help keep the neighborhood alive. And as being a West Philadelphian, and everywhere I go, and the mayor's the same way, we grew up in West Philly, we identify as West Philly, and we want to make sure that our opportunity that was given to us is the same opportunity as given to others.
Programs like these in Philadelphia have the potential to change a lot, and not just for black Americans, but they can't cover every deprived area, so smaller scale initiatives will be needed. And on the opposite coast, a group of social entrepreneurs have used their tech savvy to help reduce the very high cost of being poor.
I'm going to go ahead and form the circle and send you all the promissory notes for you to review.
Access to affordable credit is vital. How else can you borrow money to buy a car, to drive to work, or put down a deposit to rent a home? But multiple studies have shown that getting credit's harder when you're black. One showed that black applicants are asked to provide more information and ask tougher questions, while secret recordings showed bank staff were nicer to the white applicants, making jokes and being friendlier. At the Mission Asset Fund in San Francisco, they're working to fix some of that.
So right now, we finished forming the lending circle, and all participants have to sign an agreement with us where they are already saying that they will officially become part of the lending circle. And right now, everyone is signing that agreement through their phones. So we send those through DocuSign, and they're able to sign in electronically. And after that, they're officially in a lending circle, and they will be able to make a first payment on the 17th of this month.
Program coordinator Carla Hendriquez has just finished signing up five local residents to a lending circle, a type of savings group, common around the world, where members agree to put in a fixed amount of money every month, and every month one of them gets the pot.
A lot of them, this is their first time establishing credit. A lot of them came to our program without no credit history whatsoever. And what happens is that when someone in the U.S. has no credit history, it's really hard for them to go out to a bank or any other program and ask for a loan, right? Because they look at them and say, well, you're invisible. You don't have any credit history, right? So that's why they go to predatory lenders, which is really, really hard for them to pay out. And they get into this cycle of debt.
The Mission Asset Fund started as a way of supporting new immigrants to improve their credit rating by formalizing these lending circles and reporting them to credit bureau. Jose Quiñones, the CEO, explains what they set out to do when they started in 2008.
Back then, the conventional wisdom was to say that in order to help low-income people improve their financial situation was to basically do another financial class for them, kind of give them another brochure on how to manage their checkbooks. That was sort of the conventional wisdom that, you know, the poor people are just stupid, right? You know, that they don't know how to manage their money. So we essentially rejected that notion to sort of say, actually, when we actually do pay attention to how people manage their money, we can actually see a lot of wisdom. We can see how financially savvy they are in terms of how they budget, in terms of how they manage, you know, but yet our systems, our products, we don't give them any of that credit, you know, because we hold them to be sort of broken or you know, sort of like in a deficit perspective, that they're just waiting to be saved. We rejected that notion and instead said, you know, we wanted to work with them from a what we call a strength-based perspective, a perspective about uplifting what is working in their lives, of working with them in sort of a common cause, really, to help them achieve more. And so that is really the basis of Lending Circles. Now, we achieved a lot of success in the mission, you know, in how we rolled out the program here. So we set out to, you know, replicate the program within the Asian community, within the African-American community, with the Afghan community, and we demonstrated that it can actually work across the board.
Jose's now shared his model with more than 50 different nonprofit groups in 14 American states. There's another approach, too, affirmative action, sometimes called positive discrimination. It's been around since the early 1960s and continues to be controversial to this day. Are quotas for black people in jobs or education the best way to address the imbalance? It also raises another question. Does it keep people separate rather than bring them together? This dilemma of isolation versus integration is one of the longest running in black American life. And I discussed it in Wichita, Kansas, with Mark McCormick, director of the Kansas African American Museum.
If we had more African American businesses, maybe African American business owners would tend to hire African Americans more so than African Americans are being hired now by majority business owners. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But what you say is that actually segregation helped keep these communities together.
In a strange way. The saying,
kind of ironic, isn't it?
Well, the saying is that African Americans got what they wanted but lost what they had. They got what they wanted in terms of the ability to live and work and play in places where they weren't allowed to go before. But in the process, lost these really close-knit communities where they depended on each other, where you had role models in the community. Like in the community here, the doctor, the lawyer, the businessman lived next door to the hourly worker. And they all went to the same school. And there was just this collegiality there that people in my generation kind of pine for. I mean, we don't pine for the segregation, just for the closeness of the communities.
So what's the solution?
It's really tough. I mean, Americans are going to have to decide, do we want these little separate communities that operate like little microcosms, or do we really want an integrated society where we live next to each other?
And that's the question I'm going to explore in the next episode of America in Black and White, here on the BBC World Service, when I delve into the complex and sometimes surprising history of racial segregation in the United States, and try to understand its impact today. America in Black and White on the BBC World Service was presented by me, Rajini Vaidyanathan, and produced by Giles Edwards.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.